Hello, and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for today. Our program today is the Agriculture Revolution, nurturing relationships with our food sources and each other. Our panelists today, Elizabeth Carney, CEO of Zen Heart and founder of Biotica Kombucha. Sarah Day Evans, founding director of Accelerating Appalachia. Unica Rogers-Sipp, founder and chief regenerative officer of Sustainable Rural Regenerative Enterprises for Families. And Christy Dam, CEO of Tech Talk Studio, who's your moderator. Please note, it is Appalachia. We've been corrected on that one. But I'm very happy to have our panel here today. And I'm going to turn it over to our moderator, Christy Dams.
Thanks so much, Kevin. Hi, welcome to everybody. This is a topic that's near and dear to my heart. Food, culture, wisdom, toxins, all of it, because it affects us every day, everything we eat, the air we breathe, the water we drink, everything. And there's a huge revolution happening here, and I'm so excited to have these women, who are three women that are leading part of this revolution across the country. So I'd like to start today by my first guest, Sarah Day, and I'd like to ask you about Appalachia. How did you get here? How did you get to agriculture? And what led you to this place? And what led you to do what you're doing in Appalachia?
Hi, thanks, Christine. What led me? Everything. My entire life has been a trajectory of solving for air, water, land in Appalachia. I'm a sixth generation Kentuckian. I grew up with an amazing man named Wendell Berry, the father of sustainable agriculture, who influenced me hugely. I come from a family of farmers who parted with farming just one generation back with my parents, who became physicists. So it was this odd combination of agriculture and science. But all of that influenced me to go ahead and pursue science, to pursue hydrogeology, but continuing to solve for a deeply impoverished region and solving for it through what the innate skill sets and nature of that place is. Appalachia is the most agro-biodiverse food shed in North America and northern Mexico. Agro-biodiverse food shed. We have 1,500 heritage heirloom plants under cultivation. A surprising little known fact about that region. We have deep cultural history, home to the Eastern Band of Cherokees, and the indigenous wisdom inherent in our region informs our work with the first nature-based business accelerator, as far as we know, in the country. And so I couldn't separate myself from what has influenced me to be here, because it is just who I am.
Thank you. Unica, so you are from a region called the Black Belt, and I was really interested in all the parts to what this really means for the region and for all of us. But I wanted to start with, how did you get here? How did you get to agriculture? Was that always your history? How did you get here? And is this an empowering thing? Is there empowerment in agriculture for you? Can you talk to that?
Sure. Thank you, Casey. Interesting. The path that took me, that led me to agriculture, is a surprising path by many. But you know, I first was in. My first socially responsible business was in sustainable fashion. I grew up in North Carolina in a small rural town. And when I was really young, I remember a conversation, probably about, maybe I was in the fifth or sixth grade. I was around the table with my family. It was my mother, it was my uncle. My uncle is now 79, and about 2 years older than my mom. And it was my grandmother and some other relatives, and they were talking about how proud they were of my education, what I was learning. And it never occurred to me to even ask about my mom's education and my uncle's education until that point, you know. And so the conversation shifted to what their struggle was growing up. My uncle was a sharecropper. He was allowed to have his, I guess he went to about the sixth grade to get an education. And because he had to stay and help my grandfather and work the land. That was his narrative around education. My mother was allowed to go and finish high school. She didn't have to stay and work the land away, which he did. So immediately, at that table, there was like three generations of knowing that was sort of implanted in me. One was, I knew something was wrong. I knew something was, I was asking myself, why did my uncle have to give up education? Why did my mother? But it was all about our relationship to the land. So I knew immediately that there was some sacrifice that had been made for me in my education. And I knew that there was an expectation for me. At that point, and that was when my seed was planted for social justice. And so, coming back 20 years, I've always been a social responsible business. I did sustainable fashion. I did a lot of different business ventures. But it was something deeper that I wanted to address around that history. And so that sort of led me to where I am today and working. And that narrative is a narrative that I've taken with me. It's evolved over time. And it's evolved into family-based businesses and folks that really want to sort of stay on the land and keep their land. And how do you grow it sustainably? So that's how I got into it.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Moving over to you, I want to hear about how you got into agriculture. You're doing some very interesting work here, and you're also a founding member of one of the founding team of Ballet. And I know there's some of those folks here, we want to talk about that. It's a very powerful organization doing amazing things. But can you tell us, how did you get to agriculture? Have you always been in agriculture?
Well, I think in a certain way, all of our ancestors have been in agriculture, so we could all say yes to that. Thank you, Christy. I think it's so wonderful to have convened this particular panel. We are each using agriculture as a leverage point for change. For me, I really see it as being agriculture as a way to improve our lives and change our health. My picture is about changing the paradigm of medicine. Imagine if you had a food system that supported our health. What would that picture look like? And I guess I see agriculture as a connector. It connects us back to nature. It connects us to the soil and plants, which if they're healthy, then that gives us food that's healthy. And if the food is healthy, then we can be more vital and our brains can think what we need to think in order to solve all these problems. So I see these connections as being really important new connections that we can start to picture. How do we change the paradigm of medicine? Well, I don't know, but I know that my great-grandfather, one of whom was a doctor and the other one was a farmer, guess it's no surprise I'm working with using food for healing, huh? My great-grandfather changed the paradigm of medicine in the early 1900s. So I figure if he could do it then, changing the clinic system and things like what Mayo Clinic was doing, well, we can do it again. It's time to do it again. It's time to do it in a different way and to make new pictures that people can see for what that might look like. So I'm hoping we'll have a chance to talk a little bit more about that today as well.
Absolutely. Thank you. So the two of you are in a very interesting region. And all the focus has been around impact investing in Silicon Valley and San Francisco and leading the techno-agra back to roots and food and all that. But you all are actually right there, hands-on, doing it. It's happening in this very rich region. Can you each talk about your organizations, what you're involved in, and then also what this overlap is between what you're each doing? Is there an overlap? Does something meet there that actually raises all of this to a different level?
Sure.
Sarah Day.
Excuse me.
Absolutely. So our accelerator, which has actually been called a decelerator by some, we're just 2 years old. We are based in Asheville, North Carolina, but we have attracted applicants from all over the world. It's extraordinary what's going on, and we're focused on nature-based businesses. And I think that's just really stimulated the imagination of a lot of folks who are designing around nature and the wisdom of nature through biomimicry, through solving for a whole variety of sustainable agriculture. And I've got one of our folks that we're consulting with right now. I'll call him out in just a minute. He's got a really cool business. But it makes perfect sense to me that we would be launching this kind of an initiative out of Asheville, North Carolina. Once again, my most biodiverse region. Asheville has just been named the number 2 city in the country to start a business for startups from Popular Mechanics, of all folks. Number 1 destination in the country by Frommer's. People are flocking to this region. All they know is they're seeking transformation. I mean, I'm one of those folks. Transformation, they're seeking healing. It has long been a hub for healing. And healing the land and healing the folks, the people. We are abundant with botanicals. And that's where Gaia Herb has located. All of this comes out of the place, the nature of this place. And we, with all that wonderful stuff, we also have huge challenges. We're known as an insular region. We're known for extraction, poverty. Those things haven't gone away. And we're just choosing to solve for those through our deeper nature of the place to support wealth, the wealth of nature and the wealth of wisdom that comes from that place, as well as attracting folks from across the world who are also thinking along those same lines.
And I think it's important to make a distinction about the Black Belt in the southeastern United States. So the Black Belt is a region that's known for its rich, dark soil. It's also known for its historical legacy of African Americans and the economy, the slave plantation economy that's come out of it. So with that being said, there is the incredible legacy that we've inherited to really unearth, unpack that history and sort of shift it for a place of healing. You get that very much in the center of our work. We consulted when we were founding Seraph, my organization, 5 years ago, with over 500 families in the region. And I was working as a consultant with Heifer International, and they had a very wonderful program of providing capacity to families and capacity building support. And so it would be inputs like seeds, it would be a heifer. Everyone knows about the heifer program where you pass on the gift. And so, but we kind of evolved to know that it was more complex than that, than just providing the inputs, that we needed a more of a holistic approach. And so we were able to find out that it really wasn't much that we needed from the outside to implement that, because we were really implementing those approaches. We just needed the support to grow the businesses. So the way to grow in a regenerative manner was just inherent. But in terms of machinery, some of our families have fourth-generation families, farmland, and you may have a well or 3 or 4 existing wells that have been there, and it may cost $5,000 to replace that well. And if you are wanting to be competitive, if you want to grow your family enterprise, whether it's 5 acres or 50 acres of produce, you've got to have a viable water supply system. So we've been able to take the conventional wisdom that sort of rests within our families that have been deeply rooted in that land and in that space, and sort of merge it into new technology, you know, appropriate technology, just experimenting what is available to help us move towards a more less risk in our process, and something that would be long term to pass on to our children. So a lot of challenges around access. It's access to the right type of information. It's access to the right type of resources. It's access to, when I say resources, I really mean economic, the capital that it takes to just sort of grow on a trajectory. But a lot of really good things that are happening that are solid, that, like I said, are rooted deep in that history. And I would agree with Sarah that when people find out about the region and they come and experience the families and experience the culture, it is something that we have more demand than we can meet. That's why we're hosting people to travel now through trips. When I started, I didn't have that in my mission that we'd be doing developing business or tourism or travel. But that is an important part of our process because it allows us to open up the space. It allows us to get products to market without having a lot of, you know, it's immediate sort of infusion. We want to grow that. We want to have the Black Belt region sort of be able to step up to the Appalachian region in sense of tourism.
Well,
it definitely connects. But we want to be competitive, is my point. You know, we want to be able to have people who can take that industry, which is a mold. I mean, it brings a lot of support, being able to be a participant, a full player in that industry. And we want to have families and local business to be able to do that. And so that means diversifying the products. That means being able to provide the right resources for them to be able to grow those businesses, giving them the business skills. It's an incredible list of needs, but it's a beautiful opportunity for us to get together.
Well, in the South, it's amazing because part of what just jumped out at me was that you all are economic disruptors in an interesting way, because you're disrupting the paradigm that's been laid out in existence. And when you talk about all of a sudden travel and tourism, and now you're thinking about that, and wow, I mean, that changes everything, right? I mean, the disruptors today are the ones that take a business that looks like it's one model and they completely turn it upside down. It's another model, and it applies in broader ways. So I was interested too in, and then this will actually go to the health issue as well, but be a localist, right? I mean, we're talking about local business, local economies, cultures, families, farms, and food. So one of the trends I see that troubles me often is that eat local first becomes the most important piece. But if you eat local and you eat toxic, you're eating local, but you're being poisoned. So, can you talk about, we're talking about sustainability, we're talking about all these issues, how do you work with that issue? Because agribusiness, as we know in this country, has been what it's been. So now we're looking at organics, we're looking at soil, we're looking at seed, and how do we keep seed? How do we pass that forward? So I'd like for you to talk about that part of it, what you're doing and how you're helping businesses to grow and maybe think differently.
Well, the part of it that I see, I've always been an entrepreneur ever since my first restaurant business. I'm always looking at what's the startup opportunities. I think there's something like $50 billion market for startup and food right now. It's just huge. And one of the things about that is this technology piece, shortening the distance between the farmer and the eater. I mean, that's what Unica is talking about, is how can we get back in relationship with each other? And some of the technology aspects where my friends Nigel and Lorraine at Eat Well Farm can sell via an app on your phone to a bunch of different eaters in San Francisco, well, that gets to be a pretty cool thing because it takes away the distributor and the 40% that they take. It takes away the 40% that the retailer takes, or 50. All of a sudden, there's something left for the farmer. What a concept, huh? So when I first started working with the concept of local and with the idea of fair trade, because in lots of other countries, there's a concept where the farmers get a fair compensation. Well, I don't know about some of my colleagues' projects here, but I know how it was for my uncle as a dairy farmer, and he was there every single day, no vacations, and very low compensation for that. So I think part of that disruption is, how is it that we can use technology to shorten those distribution chains, and all of a sudden then maybe the farmer can start to think about getting a living wage, getting an amount that we can actually feel good about what our food is costing, because we know it's going back to our producers. So there we are, we're at either the farmer's market, or we're at a CSA where we're doing a subscription with the farmers for the whole season. We've totally disrupted the economic aspect, and now we're back in relationship with our food. So do you want to know the answer to the question of, is this food healthy and safe? Well, if we're in deep relationship with the people that we're getting our food from, then we can really start to know that, and we build trust and we build relationship with each other. And then we don't have to try to trade off between local and organic, because you have the relationships with the farmers. You know what are their practices, what are their values. And I think this is really key. When we started Bally many years ago, it was all about having local business that was empowered to keep the benefit from the exchange from customers and businesses in the community. And if you went to Walmart or one of the big boxes, that benefit did not stay in the community. It left and was, in, it went, some, all that profit went someplace else. So the initial thinking about local living economies was, how can we empower our local folks to be the ones that people think of, to go to spend their dollars with, because then it stays in the community.
I'd just like to also note that, yes, we serve local and regionally innovative businesses that are solving for that region, but we also are getting applicants that are solving for organic, solving for water saving, from, again, across the country. So there's a real value to technology as well. That we're a big fan and members of Bali, fellows of Bali, but this is a huge problem. It's kind of got to be all of the above. You can't exclude globally scaling solutions for the sake of local. So Sean's a great example. His company, Bitwater, converting farms for crickets. And if you've been reading about the high protein content of cricket flour, as well as the innovative water saving development that he's got going on with, I think it's 250th the amount of water that it takes to grow soy, and 1/2000th of the water that it takes to grow beef. This is huge. This has to be part of the conversation as well.
And I would comment that, so Sarah mentioned the comprehensive framework, that it has to be all of the above, and so it was very apparent that what we were doing also was community economic development. We work primarily in rural communities that are isolated from the main hub, maybe an hour's drive to the main hub, to a grocery store or a Walmart, if that's going to be the choice, which is typically the choice of offering, unfortunately, in our communities. But we're working on that. And so when we began to open up a value chain creation process, where we were looking at various different ways in which we measured our wealth, we realized that the built environment was really important. So we had opportunities to provide jobs for one another, or something for young people to do in the community, in addition to the agricultural business, the agriculture business that we're developing through tourism. Because the buildings have to be, you know, if you're potentially a cultural center, you have to also have buildings which people want to participate in and sit in, and they're beautiful. So we just look at all of the various things that have to do with making a community self-sufficient. And we put those all around, sort of at the core of it is what the vision of the community is, and then we surround the community with those opportunities. And so there's an incredible amount of resources, a incredible amount of information that needs to be gathered, collected, disseminated, and then we have to implement into practice. So that's something we're knowledgeable about, and we're looking at the part. That's where partnerships are so important, and that's why Bali is so important, because Bali opens up the network for regions like the Black Belt, which have been historically isolated and still are today. It opens up that network for folks who have the same values and can be investors, if you will, from far away. That's been incredibly important for us. And
can you each speak to investing and investment and impact investing? I know Kevin Jones and SOCAP, I mean, this whole impact investing is just taking off, and lots of players are arriving here. Can you talk about investing as each of you see it, and in your communities and your efforts, and in the people that you're drawing?
I feel like I'm going out of turn, but I will quickly mention that this whole concept of what we're doing, nature-based businesses, was ideated with myself and Kevin Jones, Sean Paul. Kevin's the founder, co-founder of SOCAP, Social Capital Markets. We have attracted some of the top impact investing firms to our region. New ones, Transformer Finance, Reinventure Capital, RSF. And we're working on this whole sort of pathway to prosperity through a neighborhood economics toolkit for capital arid zones, ranging from microloans, Kiva Zip. I've got a nature-based business investing club through Angels up through the impact investing firms like Reinventure Capital, a new one, which, you know, there's businesses at a minimum $2 million investment. But I mean, again, to solve for the huge challenges that we face on this planet right now, we've got to, everybody's just got to be at the table.
So for us, we're a little bit behind in the sense of that area. We're gearing up towards it. We've been supported mainly through private foundations and private individuals, some on a small scale, but we haven't really began to capture our impact investment opportunities as of yet. That's what's so good about being in the fellowship, because we are positioning ourselves for that. I mean, one of the things that is important to know for anybody that wants to invest in socially responsible business or social entrepreneur is that you really have to do the work to find them. Because a lot of times we are so passionate about the work that we're doing that we are in the community, and it's what's right in front of us. And if you're already isolated, you don't necessarily have that support network, you tend to stay in that area. And so as our organization has grown, we realize that we have an incredible role to play to be able to bridge the gap there. And to tie investors in, but our responsibility is to get our businesses, local businesses, ready for investment, and we had to figure that out. Like we thought it was just again about technical capacity building, you know, assistance and capacity building, and that we would do solar irrigation, and that would be enough. And you know, we try these other things, and that'd be enough. But about 3 years in, we realized we are actually taking the local businesses, the family farm businesses, and we are getting them ready for investment. And so that's an exciting space to be in, and particularly to be able to have a network of folks that can coach you along the way and make sure that you take those steps at a pace that makes sense as well for the business. So,
this is Elizabeth. Sarah Day and I were in Kentucky for the Slow Money Conference earlier this year, and I was reminded, really, when it comes down to investment, it's all about people. It's all about our relationships with people and finding allies. Wendell Berry was there, and he always likes to talk about ag with the little o, not with the big industrial scenario that we have today. But I think that that's where we need to come back to. Where are the people that have the same values that we do that we can get into relationship with? Because one way is certainly seed capital and funding, but there's lots of other ways in that, that textile of relationships where we can help each other and we can egg each other on, and there's lots of other things besides just money that's going to shift this. I think one of the things that's really fun to think about is like, okay, what are the pictures that we can develop for these new ways of thinking? So Michael Pollan, for example, is talking about, well, what does new agriculture look like? And I think it's many, many, many small farms, each doing things their own way, their different way. And it's going to be different in Hendersonville, North Carolina, than it is going to be in this little spot where your tourism is visiting in your district versus rural California. It's, we all have different needs. But what can be is that the uniqueness of being in a regenerative agriculture sense means that we're adding rather than taking away on the soils. Where are the micronutrients? What is the cultivation? What is the, well, I, as Kevin was saying earlier, I love to ferment. I love to ferment kombucha or just about anything else, right? Well, it turns out that compost is a ferment. And much of what we're seeing in high-tech business today is that they're discovering that there's microbes in our healthy soil that may be the key to our new antibiotics in the future. So here in the year of the UN developing this as the year of soil, I think we can really focus on what are the things that we can do to bring back our soil that's been extractive for 60 years. We've been taking out all the minerals. We've been mining it in a way. What are the things we can do to put it back in terms of compost, in terms of the mycorrhizal layer, and in terms of all of these aspects that then will feed the food that we eat, which will make us healthy. So better food equals better health. There's a part of gene knowledge today that's called genomics and epigenomics. Epigenomics is the idea that not only do the genes act on their own, but they act in the context of other, let's say the cell soup. And if you have a healthy soup that's full of nutrient density, some of the chronic disease that our grandparents might have even passed along in some genes, might not be so active due to this healthy soup. That's in contrast to if you have a stressed out soup, cell soup, that's full of fast foods and stress, a lot of the chronic disease that we might expect to get from our grandparents does show up. So there's these amazing ways that we can start to be healthier if we're in a better lifestyle intelligence, is what I call it. Nutrition, exercise and activity, stress reduction. It turns out the trajectory of our health is different. So that's how I see a new paradigm of medicine. It's much more, let's put our own hands on our steering wheel of life.
Beautiful. That ties into one of the most important parts about the resilience of the region that I work in as well, is that the DIY aspect of it is what I overlooked in terms of investment. That has been historically the way in which we funded ourselves. It's been through cooperatives. And it's a very, very rich history of that. And it's still growing. We actually recommend that people, that's part of one of those things, that's a family-centric approach to doing development. You use what you have to get what you need, and then you share, and you pull together those resources, and you continue to build with what you have. And that has been very, very, very powerful for starting up the businesses. And so we want to be able to leverage that. And we actually encourage our families to do cooperative businesses and look at those first, because that is the best way that you can keep your wealth local.
But there are also these other ways of investing as well. You know, I mean, I'm looking at the new currencies and bartering, and because those, again, those are the, how do you capture those practices that are already there, that are inherent, people are doing them, but then you are leveraging them with other resources so that it expands the experience.
Well, and like the share economy, which is it's just amazing because each of you are speaking about food, soil, and you're touching on every single issue that's going on anywhere. And here's share economy arising. It's all right here. So in terms of what obstacles are in front of you, are there barriers? Are there obstacles to things right now? Are there things that you just have to get break through or get over to be able to expand faster, or what's going on there?
We didn't see it as an obstacle. We were really excited to see that 75% of the applicants to our accelerator were women-led businesses. We've understood the wisdom, we're a women-led organization. We've understood the value of women, obviously, pretty much all my life. And it's so cool that Silicon Valley's starting to figure it out. I lived out here in the 80s, by the way. I was married to a plant geneticist at Stanford. But that being said, what we also know is that in the social enterprise world of accelerators is that women-led businesses, although 40% more profitable, are 15% undercapitalized. And I know that from my own experience. You know, and I'm just going to say it. Can I curse on radio? And I was told by one of our leading impact investors, a male, he said, Sarah Day, women just don't have the bullshit factor. And you need to work on your bullshit factor. We do tend to be very thoughtful and want to be accurate. And so I'm working on my bullshit factor. But this is a real, it's a huge challenge. We also face challenges. We select for women-led, we select for indigenous, marginalized populations, African-American-led businesses, those who have a history of having wealth extracted from their family, from their farm, from their home ownership. And this is a real challenge when you're facing the world of investment, that even impact investing, trying to hit on the triple bottom line, but I can tell you from my experience, the bottom line of profit typically still comes first in impact investing.
It does, and I will agree with Sarah that the underfunding, I mean, when we attracted investment to the Black Belt, we really, the foundation support that we had to the region, we really had to fight for it. There was an interest in the Mississippi Delta, but in the sense of the Alabama Black Belt, they couldn't see the connections, and it was just like, maybe next time. But we landed some support, and we didn't even have a website when we were funded. And so we were growing the capacity of our organization, and we had interest because obviously there was something on the ground that was working, and people were hearing about it. And so we grew programmatically, like overnight. We had $500,000 investment just given to us over 2 years. But the thing about it is that we are expected to not only build our businesses, we're expected to also build the value chain, the infrastructure as well, to be able to support the businesses. We're expected to do a lot more with less money. That was something that was made apparent when we were going through our investment process. So I think we really need to be a little bit more grounded in what it really, really takes for underserved communities to lead, for leaders in those communities to sustain themselves. There is a capacity issue that needs to be addressed. I mean, I advocate for anybody that's committed to doing this work in our regions to just be supported. Because capacity, not let us have to worry about that, you know. Let us just do this work. Let us be able to have the opportunity to show the return on investment because we are doing it. We're going to make some mistakes because the field that we're in is not everything isn't laid out in stone. I mean, we have to experiment, and that's one of the best things about this
work.
We're making it up as we go. I mean, there are some things that are tried and tested, but obviously if the things that have been tried and tested were all that we needed, we wouldn't be in the situation that we're in. So we need to be able to have the space to experiment, and we need to be able to have people that believe in us and that see the challenges and are willing to stick it in with us. Because we, you know, if we do make a mistake on the run, it's learning always with that. But don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, hang in there with us long term and make sure that we are being supported.
One of the things Unique and I were talking about in her rural settings and with families is that because we have the knowledge base on knowing how to change some of these health issues, we don't have to get diabetes or we don't have to get heart disease, because the knowledge is out there. But one of the difficulties is people need to be educated about what's the right things to eat and what's the right. So my idea is that I want to develop some of those educational materials that can be shared with people. I want to have a conference where people from ag and people from healing and people from soil, instead of all being in the silos, they're all talking to each other. This is the kind of thing that I think can help surmount some of our health issues today. We have tremendous health care costs in this country, and they're not going down. But on the other hand, the more we can use food and our lifestyle choices, the more we can be really proactive about our health and start to change that trajectory. So we spend lots of time talking about the expensive health care costs, so we must change things, but the knowledge base is there that we can change things. So it's one of those we can, but we must, but we also can.
Okay, thank you. This is the Commonwealth Club of California, and our program today is the Agriculture Revolution, Nurturing Our Relationships with Our Food Sources and Each Other. Our panelists today are Elizabeth Carney, Sarah Day Evans, Unica Rogers Sip, and Christy Davis as moderator. I'm Kevin O'Malley, Chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum, and your host for today. I'd like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Now we're going to turn it over to the audience for questions and answers. I'd like to, while we're waiting for hands to go up, I'd like to ask you guys, ladies, actually, is this a gender thing? People think of farmers as men, but then there's the image of the hardworking wife, but the man, and there's all these, how much do gender roles and past expectations affect how these movements are happening today?
Well, I can tell you one of the first things that was apparent to me in being in the field and going to tons of agricultural conferences is that you'd have, so I think of two things. So you have a lot of men who lead the conversation, but the women, this is what we say, the women get the work done. They tell our stories. And it's just a culture that's just sort of been accepted. We even have, you know, a lot of our women farmers, they say when they get visited, for example, by an extension agent, or that they talk men talk. And, you know, there's a difference in how the approach to the development is being communicated even. So all of those things are relevant in the sense of how we are shifting ourselves to be able to take this revolution, as we're calling this, you know, take this revolution forward with women at the center and leading.
I'm inclined to say stop fighting nature and integrate with nature. Stop our war with nature. We are nature. And so it's not just women, but it's people who are aware that we don't have to be in a war with nature anymore.
Well, obviously, in our case, women are solving for nature, and not just through food, farming, but textiles, botanicals, clean energy, craft brewing and distilling, another big sector for us. And just I don't know. Yes, traditionally farmers been male, although it's just been a partnership of women partners. You pretty much need a partner to run a farm. And we see a lot of young folks, a lot of young Gen Xers stepping in and taking over farms, and in our region anyway, and that's wildly encouraging.
I had a question about food preference and culture. We've talked a lot about the more progressive communities and how they embrace different kinds of innovation. Organic, locally sourced food, certainly in Asheville, that's the heart of the local food scene. But I'm curious about the role that more mainstream culture has, because it seems like a lot of that is sort of preaching to the choir. And do you think it's possible that one character in one Tyler Perry movie could impact more people than all of the preaching to the choir put together? Same thing with one NASCAR driver who only eats local organic food. You know, and do you have any interesting examples of people doing that kind of mainstream advocacy?
Food for the stars kind of thing, huh? I would answer the opposite, which is when I work with individuals, I help them look at what would their grandmother have eaten? What whole foods would they know, do they already know in their families? And that, chances are, those kinds of foods are the foods that are going to be the healthiest for them. So you don't have to do genetic testing, and you don't have to have sophisticated technology on that. But just look at what are those traditional foods. So I go back to where is the heritage of our culture on food? Maybe some of the rest of you know about the stars.
Stars is just rats spelled backwards. There's a generation of stars out there. I don't see one sort of iconic figure at this point. Certainly those folks can have an influence, but I just sort of see a mass movement happening. And from mainstream regions, like I said, we're getting applicants from all over, primarily Appalachia, many more outside of Asheville than we're actually getting from inside of Asheville. Yes, it's the bubble there, the magic bubble in Western North Carolina. But, everybody connects to food. Everybody. We have that in common. And so I see that it's a huge connected shift happening.
Okay, let me ask you a question here. So we have all these bubbling, these magic bubbles, like Northern California and Asheville, but and then now we have a tradition in the Borough South. What about places that have lost all their culture? I mean, what about the middle of Ohio? What about in the middle of nowhere that we have nothing but strip malls and it's all gone? How do we address those?
Okay, I travel a lot to middle Ohio, to West Kentucky, to East Kentucky. This is happening everywhere, Kevin. This is happening everywhere. This folks are turning to one another. I mean, just the collapse and the disenfranchisement from our economic system. It's just, you see people turning to one another in their communities to solve that. This attitude of, guess what? I don't think anybody's coming to save us. What can we do here together? You can find a farmer's market in virtually any community. So I'd have to disagree with you on that.
And I kind of take a different approach to it. I mean, the disinvestment and the disenfranchisement is there. But I think it's important to be able to know where to find culture, even, you know. But culture doesn't just show up in a strip mall or, you know, I mean,
it might.
It can. Culture is very dynamic and is often hidden. So what we've known that we knew that part of the problems that we were facing is because culture was hidden and buried, actually. And so our work is about unpacking it and shining light on it. One example is how when we do community mapping, you can do a GIS map of a community we work in, and there's nothing there, maybe one asset, a historic church. But if by the time we get done with the community participatory planning process, and we've got over 100 assets that have been lifted up from the community, because the community has said this is what's important to me. Well, if you didn't know anything about that community, you would, and looked at the GIS map or just did a drive-by, you would think, well, wow, there's no culture here, perhaps. So it's important for us to really just sort of be careful about when we think about, you know, what's being lost in culture, because it's really, really doesn't go anywhere, but it's always in the food. you will always find the hint of the food. If you can find the food, where the food is, that's where the culture is. Like, you know, and you may have to dig a little bit, but the good food is where the good culture is, so.
Also, I would say, if you don't find it where you are, why not grow it? I mean, really, it's not that hard to find a little bit of ground where you can grow something that really you love or your grandmother used to eat. I mean, certainly in Indianapolis, Indiana is one of the best grass-fed dairies in the country, so it's happening everywhere. But also, I think we can just find a little place to plant some seeds and grow something and see what happens.
And that reminds me that, you know, when we do those sort of, what Elizabeth is saying is like, when you do those discovery processes, so you find that there's a historical cemetery or there's a historical cultural center, and then you ask these questions, well, what used to be grown there? And then that's when the revitalization is spread. Well, can we grow that again? And so it's reviving a sort of historic tradition and seeds and bringing back. So it's this whole sort of unpacking. It's never that the culture isn't there. It's just that, you know, we have to go out and dig it and pour it and find it. Dig for your roots.
Allie?
Thank you for facilitating that. Well, first of all, I just want to honor the courage and innovation of the women on this panel. It's really hopeful for me as someone who's been involved in social justice and economic justice and sustainability work. And we'll all be gathering again to plug the Bali conference transparently here in June. We'll be in Phoenix together deepening this conversation, and 700 people will be coming from around the world. And I'm wondering from the panelists, because we're talking about a holistic movement that really touches on every aspect of our life, you know, from our families, which is in the title of your organization, and soil and all of these aspects. What bridges, since we're all bridge builders here, need to be built? What are the hardest bridges you see in your work that are not happening yet that, you know, we as an audience, as Californians, can look to and find ways to support?
As I think a lot of us know, some of the challenges that we face, I guess nationally, but particularly in the South, are racial bias. The numbers are staggering. I've been really following Black Lives Matter. In Bali, we've been having this conversation as well. The average net worth for a white American is $144,000, and it's $11,000 for African Americans in this country. That is staggering. And in researching the history of that and the actual extraction of wealth and property and land by policy has got us really very concerned. And having this conversation is a really tough conversation to have. It's surprising. When you begin to have this conversation, how far we still have to go. And I'm hoping that our younger generations are moving beyond that. But the inequity in wealth is a huge challenge, which is another reason that we are partnering, having these conversations about supporting African-American-led businesses. But it's huge.
I would agree. I mean, obviously, the majority of the families that we work with are African-American, and we carry the responsibility of moving beyond the burden of our history into something that's more hopeful, and which is equitable, and which is fair. And so, I think, you know, Elizabeth said it earlier, it's really important for us to have allies.
to have real alignment with people who care, whose heart, who care about doing good business, who care about, you know, socially driven businesses. It may show up messy sometimes with this kind of work, this healing work that we are all having to do, but it's extremely necessary, and it is what really matters the most at this moment.
First off, I'm a senior doing a project on our culture, learning about conventional food and organic food. But my question is for Yanika. You said when starting a farm, like, you want a diversifying products. What did you mean by that? Do you mean like different, like, technology or crops or animals? What did you mean?
Typically, just a typical agricultural business, if it's management of the land, it's a whole farm plan that's set out in the beginning. And so there's, from the most holistic perspective, it's about getting the animals on the farm and growing the produce, and you map that out with the family. But then when you're talking about opening up to other markets, for example, I mentioned tourism. When we did our research with the consumers and other investors that were coming and said this could be a profitable venture, we realized that people weren't producing anything. You know, they were producing very little. I mean, they may have been making preserves and things like that, but they weren't necessarily packaged for the consumer. So that's what I mean by the diversification. We want to bring, in a responsible way, people from far away into our communities and to be able to have this sort of shared experience. But when we also know that people want to contribute to the economy as well when they're there, even locally, there are some things that we need to supply more of. So we need to be able to have a diversity of crafts. We want things handmade. I mean, Appalachia is really sort of led in sort of handmade America that's coming out and what they're doing. It's about diversifying the base, getting more people employed in their cultural heritage traditions, cultural production, and those kinds of things.
I'd also like to just address the diversification for revenue streams for farms. And one of the most valuable things that you can have in your community is a food hub or a shared use kitchen for co-packing for your product. Makes it so much easier and it creates that revenue stream for the farmer if they can co-pack their crop, turn it into jams, jellies, whatever the product may be. And we're seeing an abundance of food hubs popping up. Louisville is the other place where I work, and it's opening the country's largest food hub. So this is the more that we can concentrate those in regions, the more successful our farmers are going to be in diversifying their revenue streams.
I also wanted to touch back on the bridge part too. There's a very powerful movement happening all around the world, but really in this country around moms. And I'm connected to Moms Across America and Thinking Moms Revolution, Taka Moms, and it's very interesting because there's a group of women who are really activists. I mean, these are some activist moms. They know what's going on. They know about the food. They have, and many of them have children with allergies, asthma, autism. And these moms are not taking no for an answer. So you have on one level the women who are taking it on, going to the EPA, testifying. They're in D.C. They are in some way allowing for this other group of moms that are right underneath all the activist moms to really dig their hands in and do things differently. So you've got the women kind of leading the charge and holding that space, and then you have these other moms who are figuring it out as they go, and they're connecting up with each other in ways that are astounding. And it's global. It's local. It's global. Sometimes I refer to women in the Midwest who are married, three children, they have white picket fences, and they're public enemy number one. I mean, they know what's going on. Don't mess with them. And so, and they're forming alliances in new and interesting ways. And so they're reaching out, and if you have a woman who has an autistic child, she'll be the first to tell you, that's just a name. But what we're talking about is gut inflammation, brain inflammation, mitochondria disease, right? That's what we're really talking about. And they go right to food, number one, every time. And these women can dance around soil and tell you about organisms in soil, and then they'll tell you about mitochondria dysfunction at the same time, and you're like, what? So it's beautiful. So in terms of building bridges and support systems here too, these women are just amazing. So those kinds of collaborations, because here we are now talking about the maker movement. Like, I mean, okay, you talk about share economy, maker movement, impact investing, okay, bottom line, Silicon Valley, you talk about all
businesses.
Right. So so I love to see those alliances that are opening up too, and those bridges that are being built.
Okay, well, unfortunately, we've reached a point in our program where we have time for only one more question. I'm going to turn it over to an audience member for that question. Then I'd like each of you panelists, including the moderator, to just give us a very quick kind of 140-character Twitter wrap-up as we're running out of time today. I would like to let our audience listening at home know today this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program is Agricultural Revolution, nurturing relationships with our food sources and each other. Our panelists today have been Elizabeth Carney, Sarah Day Evans, Unica Rogers Sip, and Christy Davis.
Thank you. Thank you all for your brilliant information. The one question I have about your agricultural revolution is, are any of you focusing on agricultural waste? And what aspect is that playing in this whole field of the whole cycle? Because there's a lot of nutrition that we've been giving away. We're doing damage to soil, even though we think by putting the waste back in the soil, there are some leaching that's going on, some methane being reduced and stuff. Is there a focus on agricultural waste taking place as well?
Absolutely. We, and again, I'd like to say, we are supporting via our accelerator the entrepreneurs who are solving for agricultural waste, for water reduction, for everything under the sun in terms of how we live as consumers on this planet. How are we reducing our impact to this planet? So yes, we have a couple of applicants solving for agricultural waste. You're right, food waste, 40%. It's huge in this country. We're worst. So we've got to solve it.
We have it as part of the curriculum. We have I think it's 18 module curriculum that deals with, it's more like, what we've done is that we've taken this curriculum, which was about social responsible business, and it looked at the environment. It's an environmental literacy curriculum. So it looked at water, it looked at energy, it looked at building, and we've now modified it, sort of customized it for our current practice, our day-to-day, our environment. And so we put it in the curriculum, we're addressing it. It is also being practiced. I mean, people are always having the conversation about, you know, the importance of it, the traditional practice, and then where there might be even some market opportunities. But overall, it's an area that seems to be, you know, it's going to take us some time to really sort of bring it up to the forefront the way that we'd like to, but it's definitely there.
Okay, we can have a wrap-up from each panelist and the moderator.
Okay, so my Twitter character closing would be that Stephanie Seneff of MIT has just done research that said by the year 2025, half of all children born in the United States will be autistic, will be on the autism spectrum, from one research only that she did around glyphosate, which is in Roundup, which is in genetically modified foods, and it's now gone beyond that. I would say eat organic, go to any length on the planet to eat organic, share organics with your family, your friends, your community, and go as organic and stand up to and say no to anything that isn't a clean, life-supportive food.
Okay, 140?
Sarah, for you.
Sarah Day.
We'll double down with you. You can have 280.
So, hey, okay, thanks, hon. Mine are the words of wisdom provided to me by Wendell very directly when I was feeling a little cynical a few years ago. He said, "Saraday, times are too dire to be anything but hopeful. Times are too dire to be anything but hopeful."
That's a quote from Wendell Berry.
And I would like to leave my Twitter, I guess, tweet would be an MLK quote, and it's, "The moral arc of the universe bends at the elbow of justice." And that is sort of on my office plaque, and it reminds me of the work yet to be done, and it makes me very hopeful about what can be done.
I would say we're growing the next generation of humans, conferring together to share ideas, working on creating conferences around these principles, creating a new ecosystem of personal health. Eat rainbow fruits and vegetables and buy them from your local farmer.
Great. Well, thank you to all of our panelists. I would like to remind people about the Ballet organization that's been mentioned, BALLE. They do have a conference coming up. The ladies from that organization up here in front, if you're here in the audience today, if you're listening at home, look them up on the internet. They have a conference coming up. Our program today has been Agriculture Revolution, Nurturing Relationships with Our Food Sources and Each Other. Our panelists were Elizabeth Carney, Saraday Evans, Unica Rogers Sipp, and our moderator, Christy Daines. My name is Kevin O'Malley, Chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum. I'm your host for today. I'd like to thank all of our listeners at home today. This is the Commonwealth Club of California. We're here on Market Street. Thanks for listening today. And with this, I will close this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 125 years of enlightened public discussion.